Welcome back to Alaska Voices. In today's episode, we will focus on the theme of upward battles, navigating hurdles and overcoming barriers.
As Alaskans put in the work to make our institutions more inclusive, many of our friends and coworkers must overcome invisible labor such as parenting, code switching, and discrimination. We reflect on ways to remove or even just acknowledge these barriers to entry.
This first conversation is between Audrey and Shannon, who are colleagues. Ryan Tui recorded the following conversation titled A Day in the Life of a University Scientist, which Kelsey Skomberg produced.
My name is Audrey Taylor. I'm 42. And my relationship to my partner, she's my colleague and my friend.
My name is Shannon Donovan. My age is 43. And the relationship to my partner is colleague and friend.
I am a untenured assistant professor of environmental studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage in the Department of Geography and Environmental Studies. I teach environmental science and conservation biology.
I am an associate professor of environmental studies at University of Alaska. I'm a conservation social scientist. I am also the chair of the department. I am tenured in 2015. And a typical day generally involves one of us running into work late.
Having dropped the kids off.
With lots of bags. We always have lots of bags.
Right.
Bags of lunch.
Bags of workout gear.
Bags of books.
Children's bags that you forgot to drop off with the children.
A bag of computers.
And then we get to work.
And then we realize we forgot one of those bags at home.
Right. The critical bag.
Hopefully not the lunch bag.
And then so we chat. Then we get down to work. And we get interrupted inevitably about 10 minutes later by something critical that has to be done right then, right that moment.
And then we teach. And then we see students.
And then we try to do research.
And then we do a lot of admin and paperwork. Meetings. Lots of meetings.
There's lots of meetings. There's a fallacy, I think, that academics have their summer off and we all sit by the pool and we drink frosty drinks and we paint our toenails and generally do nothing for 3 months.
You don't sit by your Alaskan pool?
I don't sit by my wetland in the back of my yard that has 4 billion mosquitoes per square inch.
So you say you're going to do something at the beginning of the year, actually, spring before the year starts. And then at the end, you're supposed to say whether or not you did these things. And then this activity report at the end also lists the 5,000 other things that you had no idea were going to come up between when you had to decide what you were going to do and then when you had to report what you were going to do.
The summer is the time where you're trying to get all those things that you promised to do during the year that you didn't get done. And so it ends up being pretty busy usually too. And then taking care of the kids, which are also not in school.
Which aren't
during that time.
That's right.
One of the reasons I went into academia is because I thought it would be a good balance between having a fairly intense career and having children, and that you have a lot of this flexibility and you have a lot of independence to schedule your own time and so on. But yes, it can be misleading in terms of being able to actually accomplish all the things you need to accomplish because you have your own internal deadlines, you have your own set of things you want to accomplish, and many of those are easy to push aside in favor of other things that get put on your plate. And so, and it's hard to say no because you don't have specific deadlines for things that you absolutely have to get done.
On any given week, I might do a really good job balancing work and family, but not as good of a job on getting exercise and taking care of whatever personal things that I need to do. And so I guess if you can make sure to have a balance there so that it's not always like just family and like just work, then over time, right, there can be more of a balance.
You actually told me that once. You said something to the effect of, you know, there's always one ball on the floor at a time.
At best.
On your best day, maybe two or three balls. You just have to make sure those are not always the same balls that are on the ground right. At the same time. At some point, some of the balls should be in the air. I think the other thing kids do too is make you really think about where you can double up efforts. You start exercising with your friends, so you pick friends that do exercise.
Definitely.
So you can
yes.
do that together, and you pick research projects that you can work on with people you know and like so that you get some social time while you're doing that. You teach classes where you can engage your undergraduate researchers in the class so that there's some crossover there, and that becomes sort of a way of both enjoying your time more and making things more meaningful and also just taking care of some of those times when you feel like there's just not enough time for everything, which is pretty much how I feel all the time.
Well, it can be difficult to prioritize.
For sure. Yeah, there's always a good idea in everything, right? Somebody comes to you with a proposal idea or a potential paper or a book or a class you could teach. It sounds great. It's so exciting. Somebody wants me to do something. This is fantastic. But then you have to figure out where in the priority landscape it fits without losing sight of all of the other things that are currently on your plate and things you might want to do in the future.
There's a culture here, too, of women working moms who are wanting to outdoing each other of like, well, I put the baby down at 8, but I still had to stay up until 2 in the morning to finish this grant. And so that is maybe just the nature of the overachieving beast, you know? And that's what draws a lot of people to academia, right? It's like really a bunch of like overachievers.
Or pushes people away, the idea that right. You have to do that.
I mean, we all have to do it sometimes. You know, it's just the way it goes. You just have sometimes those deadlines creep up and too many balls have dropped and you find yourself pulling a all-nighter, near all-nighter. And luckily, you know, I don't have nearly as many of those as I used to. But I think there's quite a lot of people who are doing them either because they don't recognize that they have the opportunity for flexibility or the support to create their flexible schedule, or it's just innate in them to want to work the hardest, do the most. Be the best as is part of the academic culture. Audrey, you're going to be finding out about tenure soon. And I think it's important to note that, you know, I'm obviously super confident that you are going to be granted tenure because, you know, you embody everything that a tenured professor should have in terms of community engagement, professional engagement, and high quality teaching practices.
Well, and I had a good model to learn from when I came here, thanks to my excellent colleague, Shannon, who taught me everything I need to know about work-life balance.
That's right. And, you know, the good news about having a working mom around is if you get hungry, you can always find snacks in her purse.
There's always going to be a fruit bar somewhere. Well, thank you very much. I learned a lot today.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun talking with you. I know, super fun.
And so I'm kind of curious, Jesse, what you thought about after listening to that conversation.
It's clear they have a really good relationship and that they have so much understanding of each other, just their flow between them in terms of understanding their daily routines. When we go into the year, we have a workload plan of what we say we're going to do for the year and how it's going to be divided up in these different units. And then at the end of the year, we report on what we actually did. And of course, they talked about that struggle. And in my mind, it's also an anxiety because I feel like I'm looking backward to see what I failed on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what that reminds me of too is something that my grad advisor said to me. He said, "You'll never have a time where everything will be done ever."
Yeah.
And he said, "You will get stuff done, but there's always, always, always going to be more." And sometimes I see it as an opportunity and sometimes I see it as a stressor.
I have a colleague that works outside of the university. He gave me some advice that I've really taken to heart and thought about over the last number of years. And this came from his mentor. And I'm just sort of paraphrasing here, but he said, "Bob, you're always going to be constantly struggling with trying to juggle everything that's going on with your life, with your work, all the different responsibilities of work. The trick to figuring out this balance and this juggling act is to figure out which balls are made out of rubber and which ones are made out of glass."
This next conversation is between Jill and Rachel, who were summer students in the Research Experience for Undergraduate Students program, the REU program, and they discuss their experiences as early career scientists.
Jesse Robertson recorded the following conversation titled Grad School Files, which Teresa Bacher produced.
My name is Jill Brooks. I'm 21 years old, and I'm talking to my roommate slash colleague slash friend, Rachel Pattison.
I'm Rachel Pattison. I am 22 years old, and I'm with my roommate slash friend slash colleague.
I grew up on a dairy farm, and I come from a fifth generational family of dairy farmers, so it's like just a very inherent part of me, I think. And when I went to school, I kind of realized how important that was and how much a part of my background and my identity that is. And so I pursued then ecology classes and biology classes and decided to become an environmental studies major to kind of combine my interest in the natural world and then also with the human world that uses that natural world.
I actually grew up in foster care and in an orphanage most of my life. And academics and school was the thing that I could go to, and it was kind of the escape from, you know, the abusive world that I was in with my parents or foster care. It happened to be that environmental science was something I found a lot of interest in. I grew up in Louisiana. You know, I grew up around flooding and hurricanes and tornadoes, and it was something that I saw was becoming very dangerous throughout the years. It was increasing throughout the years, and I thought environmental science was a really good way to connect people's problems and also Earth's problems and learn about the physical world, yet the social science world too.
I think that the way traditional science works is you're very siloed into your discipline, and it can be easy to do your thing and like get funding and publish your papers without ever stepping out of that vacuum of what your science is. But it's always going to be a much richer and more useful experience if you can do that and if you can connect with other people. Something we've talked about a lot or just vented about is being a woman in the scientific world.
I think coming to this program was actually kind of my first experience with the divide between men and women in certain fields. And this is also the first program I've been in where I've truly faced sexism in the science field, because for where I'm from in Missouri, you know, I'm all around women who are in my science field and undergraduate studies. So we had this meeting with a very well-known scientist, and he was explaining everything scientific about at the aspects of climate change and why he doesn't think climate change is human caused. And one of his points were that we shouldn't fund the Paris Climate Agreement. And he didn't agree that we should be helping impacted communities at all, no matter if climate change is real or not. You were at the meeting, so I don't know if you have a different take on what happened.
Yeah, the presenter was saying politics shouldn't be a part of climate change, and it's become something that's less scientific now because we have all of these big international treaties and accords that are very politicized and have a lot of money tied up into them. And I think the point Rachel was making was like, well, it is inherently political because people are being affected by it, and the men in the room didn't agree or couldn't see it that way or didn't want to recognize the connections between the two. Before coming to this program, and I hadn't realized how big of an issue or how much of a gender divide was still present in this world of science. And so it's been eye-opening to realize that and to see just the different little like microaggressions and different ways that manifests itself.
It's just such a taught thing to people. You know, there's all these stereotypes in the world, and a lot of people don't know that what they're thinking in their mind can come out as a microaggression. And, you know, I feel like it should be something that should be taught in schools, or it just shouldn't be put on the person who's facing that oppression to have to teach everyone you meet in every environment and every school why they're doing something wrong.
It's frustrating. But it also is kind of like fuels my fire, I feel like, because it makes me angry and is like a challenge. So I feel like it drives me forward on my path where I feel like I want to bring feminist perspectives to the science world. And it's exciting, too, because I think that could transform the scientific world in a really positive way. Yeah, this was a good conversation. Yeah, felt very healthy to release.
So what sorts of things crushed through your head when you were listening to that, Jesse?
I appreciate the wisdom that they have as undergraduate students already about, you know, the differences between disciplinary and interdisciplinary work, and their perspective of interdisciplinary work is having science be very inclusive, not just of people from other disciplines, but also of community members. What was also interesting was to hear him discuss the divide between men and women in the sciences that they experienced. And as part of becoming more inclusive. I think being more inclusive of all genders, including non-binary, and I think the conversation will move in that direction. It also makes me think about how we'll be able to better incorporate the human component in sciences or fields that don't normally include it,
mm-hmm.
and you know how that will change trajectories of research.
Our next conversation is between Elena and Jessica. Elena is the Education Outreach Director at the International Arctic Research Center, and Jessica is a PhD student at UAF. Jesse Robertson recorded the following conversation titled Connecting as Scientists and Mothers, which Kelsey Skumberg produced.
My name is Jessica Guerin. I am 41 years old. And I'm at UAF talking with my mentor and friend, Elena.
I am Elena Bautista Sparrow. I am 74 years old, or young. And we are at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I'm talking to Jessica Garone, who is my mentee.
How do you feel your role as a scientist has influenced your role as a mother and vice versa?
Being a scientist, you know, helped me in my motherhood because then it helped me think of, you know, the things that a mother requires to be able to raise a child. And so I went in with both head and heart. Our children would always ask questions and say, oh, why can't you say it this way? And so I realized that communication is very much a part of science. Really, it's hard to balance work and family life. I know that there are times when work will take 100% and there's zero time for family. But then there will be the other side where you have 100% on family and zero for work. And it should be okay. We should be allowed to do that. And I'm not sure that our current system is able to absorb that.
I think that what you said was very enlightening, especially the part about sometimes it's 100% work, sometimes it's 100% family. And oftentimes it's some balance of something in between.
Yes.
As somebody who's been university staff for the last 15 years while getting my master's degree and PhD, working full-time as a mother and a wife as well, I feel like balance is something that's hard for me to achieve. It's also can be really lonely because I'm going through all of these things and my peers are not. I think that's one of the reasons why I felt connected to you all those years ago, because you understood where I was. Did you feel like you had support from your boss to do all the things that you needed to do?
Yes, yes. That is really actually very important. And actually, it wasn't just being a mother, because I was also a daughter to a mother who lived with us. And in the Philippines, it's not uncommon to have three generations in one household. And so as my mother got older and her health was not as good, you know, she needed care.
You are very fortunate that you're able to take that time.
Yes.
To be with your kids and with your mom.
Right. It would be really good if we could have a child care. Because at NSF, they have a floor where the employees' children are there so that you can go visit your children during at your breaks or lunchtime or whatever. So it kind of, you actually are more productive because you're not worrying about what's happening with your child.
Yes. Because of childcare and the stress of having strangers raise your children for 9 hours a day so you could be a full-time person. Mm-hmm. It's the reason why we didn't have any more. So at least I can not waste the gift and I can continue to be a leader by getting my PhD. And whether I'm a leader in this institution or whether I bug out like all my other girlfriends to join the consulting world, as long as I feel like I'm making an impact, then I will feel like I have been successful. I still don't feel like I'm done. I still feel like I'm on the path. I still feel like I'm starting.
You say that we're never done. You're right. I'm never done as a mother. I'm never done as a wife or as a daughter. Of course, my mom has died since, but I can be a daughter to other people who are treating me like a daughter. And so as a scientist, and whatever we choose to be, you know, scientist and educator, we're never done, which is good because once we think we're done, we're dead. I think there's always room for growth and for learning more of how to do our profession, our personhood better. You have been a delight and a joy. I think you are on a path. You don't need to compare yourself with others. You can make your own path and be successful. You are already successful in my eyes. I'm with you and I'll be with you in all your efforts if you allow me to.
Thank you, Elena. I would love to have you. And I look forward to you being there on stage as one of the folks supporting me when I get hooded.
Looking forward to that.
Jessica defended her PhD dissertation earlier this summer, and she'll be walking across the stage in May, this upcoming May, with Elena. And so I'm happy about that as well, that the circle's complete.
Yeah. Like what Elena said, you know, we're never done. Mm-hmm. And that's similar to what my grad advisor said, you never get everything done. Not everything is some checklist of stuff that we get done every day. Not being done is actually a sense that we're still alive and here and supporting our families and being alive. I recorded the following conversation between Bob and Scott, who are colleagues and friends, and it's titled Making Space for Varied Voices, which Kelsey Skonberg produced.
This conversation may not be appropriate for all audiences, as it mentions sexual assault. My name is Bob Bolton. I'll be 49 in a couple days. I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska, with Scott Rupp, my friend and colleague.
My name is Scott Rupp. I am 50 years old, and I'm talking to my friend and colleague, Bob Bolton. I know you're quite passionate about making sure that the work environment here is as fair and as level as possible, and I'm wondering how that interest and passion evolved. Is it something that's always been there, or was there a reason that all of a sudden that came into the forefront for you?
It's definitely something that's evolved over time. I had a very good friend in my undergraduate degree who was female, who basically told me that I was messed up at times and needed to fix things in my mind regarding some of these things. That's where it sort of started, but then where it became more to the forefront for me is I had a colleague on a project that I was working on that was actually assaulted in the field under my nose, and I had no idea that the harassment and the assault or anything leading up to the assault was actually taking place. It was a definite gut punch to me and made me rethink my own values and what's going on around me, and made me open my eyes a lot more and become more aware.
It's really interesting to realize how unaware you can be of many of people's lives around you. Mm. You know, since we're just on audio here, people might not realize that we're both solidly white middle-aged guys in academia. That kind of puts you in a spot that can make it seem like everything is fantastic and it must be that way for everyone else, but mm-hmm. it really isn't. What I like about your approach of just talking to a lot of people is the best way to get an understanding of other people is not talking yourself, but listening. And that's something that I think a lot of us are not good at. And that's another part of academia, right? If you're not talking, then you're at the back of the line. So you have to be very assertive and jump in there.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why I'm good at the listening part, because I'm not super assertive in some of these things.
It's such a highly competitive environment that it's pretty easy to not have any time or energy left to focus on the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of long, hundreds plus years institutional barriers for some of these things.
Yeah.
Science is a long game, right? In pretty much any discipline. And if you look back just over our careers and our particular disciplines, you can see how opportunities in various aspects of science have evolved, and it all took coordinated incremental change by the science community to make that happen.
But when I talk to people that are in the field or in the classrooms and these incremental changes, I see that as being like significant progress over the last 5 years. And when I talk to these people, they're like, I am so sick of the status quo. I am so sick of incremental changes. I am sick of this. And so that makes me want to like skip step two, skip step three, move on to step five, or what we're trying to get to. And it's frustrating because people behind me that I'm trying to support, they're frustrated and they don't see the change. They don't feel the change. I see the change.
It's easy to be satisfied with incremental change when the incremental change is not affecting you, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've got it good, and we see that things are changing for others, and so that's a positive thing. But if it hasn't changed enough for them to feel as good as we do, then, it probably mm-hmm. looks really, really different through their glasses.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just don't know where to go. And I've always been this goal-driven person, right? It's like I have a goal. And I know there's steps that I take to follow that goal. And I'm like, I've gotten to point one, just awareness. And now I'm not sure what point two is, step two is. It's frustrating. And so in your mind, what do you think are the next steps?
There's a balance to play. We need the soft money that comes in to support the science to make just about everything happen. And so even if I wanted to put all my energy over here, if I do that, then we potentially don't have enough funding to support the people that make you want to move over here, right? I don't know how to get around that, but it just seems to me we need to get more people that are desperate for the change to be in a position of making the change and not looking to others to affect the change for them. In all aspects, whether it's staff or students or other faculty, is just whenever you can do anything to help them succeed, you just need to find the time to do it, even really little things. I think it's really fun to be able to do any small thing that empowers others to reach for their goals. That's a lot more satisfying than publishing a paper.
Thanks for doing this.
This was fun. I like talking about this sort of thing with you.
So it's been, 3 years since you recorded that with Scott. I'm just wondering what came up for you listening to that again.
Well, I think it was clear, at least in my voice, that there was a level of frustration about not knowing what's next or what are the next steps. And I think we've taken a number of steps. The thing that came out is that we're still a long ways away from the fieldwork safety stuff. The conversation transcends the
the world that we live in at the university and in the field, and that we're talking about just the world we're living in and the Black Lives Matter movement and how people are tired of incremental change. And as the privileged white middle-aged male in academia, like, I see change and I'm pretty comfortable with the change that's taking place, but I know it's not enough. What about you?
I think what stood out to me is something Scott said, that people have to be assertive to jump in order to share their voice. And some of that is personality, different personalities, mm-hmm. but also, of course, different cultures. Not everyone is comfortable being assertive or running to the front of the line or interrupting somebody or somehow talking over people. And so what does it mean to have an environment where all these different factors are accounted for so that we hear people that aren't the people that run to the front of the line?
So you led a committee, the chancellor appointed you to run a committee on, I forget the name of the, but it was basically an inclusivity, diversity, but it was also a caring, making the university a more caring place. And so what came out of that committee in your mind or your own work?
I'm not good with just general concepts in terms of, like, let's make things more inclusive. Let's just, like, well, what does that actually mean? What does that mean in terms of boots on the ground? Because if we don't know what we want it to look like, you know, like pen to paper, very tangible stuff, then how can we ever make it happen? And I think we'll just see how things evolve at the university as these actions and measures move into place. Our next conversation is between Brooke and Krista and is titled Researching Salmon as a Student of Two Worlds, which I recorded and Kelsey Skonberg produced.
My name is Krista Herringa. I am 32 years old, and I am talking to my friend and colleague, Brooke, today.
My name is Brooke Wright. I am 36 years old, and I am here with my friend and partner, Krista.
Let's try to remember when we first were introduced to each other.
I was just beginning the tribal management program at UAF, and I went to one of the symposiums, and you were there. And our connection was your relation with my midwife, who I absolutely adore.
Yeah, my mom. So we're kind of like sisters instantly. And I had been going out to Ruby for a few months, maybe about 6 months, and talking to them about what sort of research that they would be interested doing with the university. And we ended up talking about how the food system is so interwoven and so connected to the fish and animals that are right around the community. And so they told us that really they wanted to focus on the whole picture. I was thinking about how I was going to move forward with that and who I was going to ask for help. And I remember you walking across the parking lot just in front of here. And I think you must have said something about how TCC just got this grant to do the food security assessment for one of the communities. And I was like, great, I know exactly who to ask. And I think that's when we really started working a lot more closely together. So Brooke, I was wondering if you could describe just a little bit about where you're from.
So I am currently living here in Fairbanks with my family so we can get our education. The educational opportunities weren't available when my children were ready for school in my hometown, which is Rampart. And it is a small Athabaskan fishing community located, I would say, mid-Yukon River.
I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about your motivation and sort of what's driving you to pursue education along with your kids.
So I started out in the tribal management program and learned so much about the histories of our people and honestly the inequities that our people have faced through history, and it kind of motivated me to get involved. And I am still a student in both worlds because I'm still learning from my mother, and I want everything that I do to be exactly the way that she knows and the way that she's teaching me, because eventually that's something I have to teach my children.
Can you describe or talk about maybe some of the challenges of being educated in two different systems.
I feel like I have to learn a system that wasn't really designed for my way of life. You know, statehood wasn't very long ago, so it's kind of the relationship has not been solidified yet.
Can you describe the boards or commissions that you're currently serving on?
I started my career now through my tribal nonprofit, Tanana Chiefs Conference, in the Hunt and Fish Task Force. I applied to be on the Yukon River panel, which is appointed by the governor, so I'm an advisor there. And then I'm also the chair of the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission, and that was a selection by the tribe. We had one of the lowest runs on the Yukon River in 2013, and that's when the tribes came together from all areas of the Yukon River and decided to do a stand down, no fishing, in 2014. And I remember that year going home and being at the water, and it just felt dead. Like, it didn't have life to it. We weren't harvesting. Even if we wanted to harvest, we wouldn't have gotten anything. And that was kind of a driver eventually to what I'm doing now. I'm also in the Alaska Salmon Fellows Program, which is a new initiative by the Alaska Humanities Forum. And it was very competitive. And it's from all sectors, so subsistence, commercial, sports, personal, management, conservation folks were all together looking at the current salmon system and what we need to do as individuals and as a group to improve that system. And what else do I do?
That's a pretty long list, right?
Okay. So after all of this work that I do in the winter, I go home and I practice my traditional harvesting with my family. And that's really why I do the work that I do. It's more than just the salmon. It's part of our culture. It's spiritual. It's identity. It's health and wellness. I feel that we all have a role at the smokehouse, and that gives you some worth, you know, in your core. Like, you have a role in this family and you're important. I feel that I will be part of getting that equal governance system in the state. So, you know, the federal, the state, and tribal, that they're all equal governance systems. And through the work that I do at Tanana Chiefs Conference, we've had a lot of partners like yourself that, you know, believe in the vision that we have. And, you know, it's providing basic rights to our people, you know, being able to harvest the salmon and the moose that they're so dependent on, especially being so remote in Alaska. Our elders and even myself are setting up our kids to be knowledge bearers more so than we are, because they'll have more opportunities than we did. For example, my 3-year-old daughter is going to be a student at the language immersion school that Fairbanks Native Association just created. And so, you know, my 3-year-old might be teaching me how to speak my language. Mm. And that makes me so happy.
Something that I really look up to you in is your humility in the work that you do and the strength that it actually carries. You're in a lot of very contentious realms because people are very passionate about fish and about the decisions that are made. And yet you always manage to treat people with respect and with compassion and care, no matter what side of the debate that they're on.
Thank you, Krista. I really appreciate that.
Listening to Brooke tell Krista about her experience of navigating academia as an Indigenous person reminded me of some things I talked about with Melinda Chase a couple weeks ago. Melinda Chase is the tribal liaison at the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center. And so I just want to thank you for doing this. I really appreciate that. And so you obviously think about climate and climate changes and climate impacts. Has that always been a strong part of Melinda?
No, I would say not consciously. I do remember, though, when I was younger and I was in Anvik, my uncle had me take care of the weather station. And I did not remember that until I was 2 years into this position.
Oh.
And then I always was fascinated by clouds and was interested in geology. It shocks me that I think that by the time that I was entering middle school, I didn't believe that I could do science. And I think that's, in my mind, is sort of the shame of it. It's that it's a process that people can get, people can understand. And it's like, how do you cultivate a relationship with the land at the same time thinking about what does it mean to just be curious and ask questions? Mm-hmm. And then say, how does this need to change? The experience that so many of us have, particularly from the Alaska Native community, is a really fragmented Western education experience. There's different pockets of people that have had more positive experiences, but I think for me to remember at different times I've had a curiosity, a natural curiosity, mm-hmm. and then somewhere in the educational side of my experience, the formal education side, that one, I either never thought I could pursue it or didn't know how to pursue it or that I had the capability. And I think the other piece is I clearly remember, and it was only in 2016 that I understood the carbon system. When I mentally followed that and understood it, what immediately followed for me was this huge immense of anger within a minute or two. And it was this anger over an educational system that could not teach to holistic thinking. And I still think that that's the case. I guess part of it is the opportunities that have been right before our eyes all these years. You know, our folks would have such an easy time in this field, and why is it that there's just such a clear break at different times with people? I would say on one hand, I didn't have a relationship, and on the other hand, we all do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense. So was there a tipping point or an event that happened that made you think more about the climate in more as you do now?
I was asked to be part of a project on climate change communication. And I just thought of it as a project
mm-hmm.
that came from an education point of view, right? But it happened in our space, and it happened with our own people, right? Mm-hmm. So we had the climate camp out at Howard Luke's Galea camp. That experience helped me to understand the changes that we're going, you know, that our Earth is going through right now, and then the impact. But in terms of language, that's the other piece. It's a particular challenge when it comes to both mainstream or Western science and climate science, because it has its own language, and then there's academic language. And then we have our own experience with language that has got all kinds of feelings wrapped around it, both depending on where we're at with our native language and if we're in a state of it being asleep or if it's being actively used and being revitalized. If people have had an experience, had a positive experience or a negative experience in an academic or school setting. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot to that, mm-hmm. and we've got to remember that when we're trying to come together.
Yeah.
And circle back around to it.
Yeah.
Often. You have people that may or may not understand the carbon system, and at the same time, clearly understand that everything is connected.
Our last conversation is between Aurora and Joanna, both graduate students when they recorded their story.
This conversation is titled Sounding Board on the Antarctic Ice Sheet, that Jesse Robertson recorded and Teresa Bacher produced.
My name is Aurora Roth. I am 25 years old, and Joanna is a friend, a colleague, a peer, and a soul sister.
And my name is Joanna Young. I am 33 years old. My relationship to my partner is that she is a dear friend, a colleague, and a soul sister.
In some ways, I was happy to have the role as like the peacemaker and communicator because I came in very last minute. And so once I found my role as this like peacemaker, it was like, okay, this is my role on the team. It's not so much science, it was more communication.
So did you take that role on yourself, just seeing a need for it, or was there ever a conversation?
Yeah, I just took on that role. It needed to happen. We needed to make sure that we saw each other and respected each other, but was pretty exhausting. There was one time sitting in the cook tent, people were getting ready for bed, and I was just sitting and writing in my journal. The other woman came in and started talking to me about some problems she was having with one of the people on our team. And I was, you know, listening and trying to help, you know, her figure out ways she could address this or conversations she could have or ways she could approach a conversation. We finished that conversation and then she left and went to bed. And then another field team member came into the tent and started, you know, expressing his frustrations to me about things he was experiencing. Then he left, and then a third field team member came in. And so I was kind of like the field team therapist. And there was a joke on the field team that, oh, Aurora just likes to talk about feelings all the time.
I'm curious to hear maybe an example or two of some of the sort of divisive issues that came up between the women and the men on the field and maybe how you navigated those.
It came down to communication styles. And then there are the little things, right? I feel like every woman in the field sciences has stories like this where you are not asked to help fix something, or if you're working on something, a man will come in and start spouting expertise and knowledge that you didn't need. You were doing fine fixing that snow machine or fixing that instrument.
Yeah. Did you and the female graduate student talk about the challenges of going to the bathroom when there's a bunch of dudes around and you're in the middle of the Antarctic ice sheet? And
yeah, definitely. The biggest difference is that you're wearing these Carhartt bib overalls to do work in, and every woman in Antarctica is issued a funnel. So you learn to pee with this funnel into a bottle or even just standing like a man. But that was time, you know, out of my day and out of my field prep that I like had to spend learning how to pee into a funnel. But just having, you know, another woman to talk about that with, and she had, you know, been to Antarctica for a couple seasons already, and she was the one that said, make sure you practice in the shower.
It's frustrating to me that the bathroom thing has to be such an issue. It's something that comes up in every field experience. Like, we just haven't figured out how to give one another privacy yet, because I think men really take it for granted.
You know, it's a funny thing that you can like laugh at, and it's kind of hilarious, but it is so emblematic of larger sort of systematic ways that field teams are run, or conversations that are being had or are not being had, that would make women feel so much more welcome in the field.
I think that's a big part of it, is just having these conversations. As a junior scientist who's been sort of working my way up through the ranks slowly and is not at the top yet, it can be really hard to advocate for yourself and to have those conversations and to bring it up. And it's not just the bathroom thing, right? It's also all of the raunchy jokes that people bring out in the field, because for some reason everybody treats the field like it's a safe space to say whatever you want. It's also all the other microaggressions like you describe. A good field team leader could just put that all out there to start. But that culture change is really slow to be happening. It's really slow.
It's also something that I think about too. I would love to be in a field team leader position down in Antarctica, and how I would do that differently is have those conversations right up front. And people might joke about it and say, you know, Aurora just wants to talk about feelings all the time. But I'll just power through, and we're going to talk about feelings and talk about these softer things beyond just science, because that's what actually makes effective science and makes the best science, is when a team's working well together.
So Aurora talks about the roles that we
each take on, which I think it's a normal human thing to take on roles when you're in a social system, right? So the roles that we might take on at a field camp. But the other thing I think that really resonated with me are, you know, she found she was often not asked to fix things or to help out with things, or if she was working on something, somebody, I guess a gentleman, might come over and take that from her or do it for her. And it's funny, the experiences I've had have been kind of similar, like if I'm trying to carry something, you know. But then on the flip side, you know, there's a lot of stuff I have a hard time carrying. Like I can't carry a 100-pound battery and things. And so, like, for me, it didn't particularly bother me. I just found that part of it amusing. And I was like, oh, this is kind of a common thread.
Sort of a funny experience with Lily out on the Seward Peninsula. And we were driving on snow machines to our field site for a snow survey. We stopped and I went to the bathroom and she was like, hey, Bob, I'm taking a survey. How difficult was it for you to go to the bathroom just now? And it's like, and I had no idea what was going on. And it's just like, oh, not very hard. You know, it's just like, oh, okay. Just wanted to check and make sure my perception was correct. And then soon after that, it was she put out an article in Scientific American in a blog that was talked about the little things of being in a male-dominated sciences and just the little things that add up, you know, that's not career altering, or, but it's just another challenge, another barrier that you have to overcome. And throughout like all these conversations, you know, it's like, there are definitely these little challenges that like death by a thousand cuts, right? Not one stab wound is enough to end a career, but it's enough to, it wears on you. And I can imagine it wearing on you. We'll be releasing a conversation between Lily and myself on our website that touches on many of the topics of today's show. Our next episode will focus on the theme of new surroundings and new beginnings.
As a preview of our next episode, we will leave you with a clip from Scott and Terry.
I sort of meandered through science doing what seemed interesting and novel at the time. And almost always what I learned was that the things I was doing in retrospect, weren't very important. It became really clear that ecosystems are changing fast, and a lot of that has to do with human activities.
Alaska Voices builds bridges by creating a space where community members, friends, policymakers, and scientists can share stories and place-based knowledge. This project was developed in partnership with StoryCorps and was funded by the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center. Additional funding was provided by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor through a generous gift from the Bentley Family Trust. Alaska Voices would not be possible without the help and efforts of an amazing group of people. Our producer and audio engineer is Kelsey Skomberg of Mossy Stone Media. Our podcast and outreach specialist is Michael DeLue, and our website designer is Carolyn Rosner.
We would also like to thank the musicians whose songs we heard today. Arctic Evening by Marcel Dupriez, Bay, Freezing But Warm, and L'Etoile Danse Part 2 by Maiden, Chante de Tournesol, This Is Happening and Time by Komiku, Horizon Ending by Soft and Furious, Tender Moment by Jonathan Bartman, So Cold and Thinking by Raphael Archangel, and Blue and A Bit Sentimental by Mon Plaisir.
If you are interested in more conversations or information, please visit our website at alaskavoices.org.
For Alaska Voices, I'm Jesse Robertson.
And I'm Bob Bolton.